I'm going to talk tonight, in fact I think this is the last of the talks about the Bodhicharya Avatara, because next week there's a talk that kind of links the Bodhicharya Avatara with another set of literature, but this is almost the last talk on the Bodhicharya Avatara, and it's a talk in a whole series that we've had over the last few weeks, and the series of talks have been on the main things that Shantideva, the author, talks about in this work called the Bodhicharya Avatara, which is translated variously as the guide to the Bodhisattva path, or as other things, but that'll do for the moment. You remember that we started off with a talk about the puja, because the puja that we do in the FWBO, in fact all the pujas we do in the FWBO, are all based on the Bodhicharya Avatara. So we had a talk on the puja, and then we've had various talks on the six perfections, because Shantideva says the way to train as a bodhisattva is to practice the six perfections. And we've had talks on sila and shanti from Kanasuri. We had a talk last week on meditation from Vajratara. Pranya is going to be kind of covered next week in the link talk, and you'll hear more about that at the end of my talk. Generosity was really covered in Vedanya's introduction to the Bodhicharya Avatara. So the one that we're missing out at the moment is Virya. And I'm going to talk about Virya tonight. And Virya is very loosely translated as energy. So, yeah, the first thing that occurred to me when I began to think about this talk is, was Shantideva's nickname. Those of you who were here at the beginning of the series on the Bodhicharya Avatara will remember that Shantideva didn't have a very good reputation at the University of Nalanda where he lived. And he didn't go out of his way to impress other people or to engage in debate and do all the things that the other inmates of the university did. And he was given a nickname called Eats, Sleeps and Shits, because that's what the other monks thought was all he did. And I thought, that's ironic, isn't it? So I'm giving the talk on Virya from the work by the chap who was nicknamed Eats, Sleeps and Shits. I don't suppose that his colleagues at the University of Nalanda would have chosen him to talk about Virya. And that led me to think about, well, so what did they do with their lives? What were they doing with their energy? And I made a list of the things that they might have been doing. So they were academics as well as being monks. So they were probably spending a bit of time writing learned papers. They were almost certainly networking a lot. They were doing a lot of debating, which sometimes meant making their point of view very forcibly and very volubly, and sometimes meant hanging out in the debating hall, sort of catcalling and cheering. They were probably doing quite a lot of building their reputations. They were probably promoting their ideas. They were probably undermining other people's ideas, either with criticism of their actual arguments or perhaps just by subtle hints about about their characters, about their worthiness and so on. They were probably competing for the most prestigious teaching opportunities. They were probably... they were probably looking for the times they could speak to the biggest audiences, giving keynote lectures. They were probably trying to get themselves really good study facilities, the best rooms, good quality parchment. They were probably trying to arrange tasty food, get good living accommodation. Maybe they even spent a bit of time going to the marketplace, seeing what was going on, hearing the gossip, speculating about how much a local celebrity was earning, and so on and so on and so on. And actually, I began to think, so it's not so different really, is it, from the sorts of things that we do, actually. The sorts of things that most of us do in a lot of our lives. Looking after our careers, trying to further our careers, maybe trying to earn a bit more money, earn a bit of prestige, get a comfortable life, get nice food, and so on. And actually the main difference is just, well, the culture that we live in is very different, and we're not living a celibate life, so we've got families and romance sometimes to think about, and that probably would have been out of, that probably wouldn't have been in their bag. But on the other, you know, in other ways, not so different really. So then I was thinking, okay, so which then's more like our lives? Which has affected, which, you know, Tranchi Deva's life or his colleagues' lives, which has affected more people for the good? And, well, which is more likely to lead to the arising of the bodhicitta? When you think that Shantideva's Bodhicharyavatara has probably been one of the most studied Buddhist texts of all time, I think the answer is fairly clear, really. So, yeah, that leads me on to a misconception about energy that we should probably get out of the way straight away. And that is that virya is not measured by the amount of activity we engage in. Okay. So Gampopa, who was a greatly revered Tibetan medieval teacher, said that the definition of laziness was to be constantly active in politics and business. Okay. Which pretty much writes off as lazy most of the people we respect in our society, doesn't it? It certainly writes off the bigwigs in business and in politics, the people who we read about in the papers every day. And actually, it writes off a certain amount of the activity that perfectly ordinary people engage in. So, you know, all the activity that's about just arranging things to our liking, just you know, getting nice places to live, nice food, gathering wealth, going on nice holidays. Those things, perfectly all right in themselves, but if they're all our lives are about, well, Gampopa would say it's laziness, that sort of activity. And Patril Rinpoche, who I'm not quite sure who he is, but he came up with a good quote, so I'm going to read you his quote as well. He said that laziness is about being involved in trivial activities. And he compares trivial activities to the ripples on water. He says they're absolutely endless, and they make it completely impossible to find time to practice, never mind to get anywhere near enlightenment. So, on the days when I'm dashing around trying to tick off all the things on my to-do list, I'm not being energetic. Okay, so we'll get that misconception out of the way. Virya is something a bit different from that. So what is it? Although usually virya is translated as energy, apparently it comes from the same root as our words for virtue and vigour and virility. And it's really a subtle balance between two things. It does involve movement, it does involve action, what we traditionally think of as energy, but it also involves pursuit of the good, pursuit of the virtuous, pursuit of the truth. So it's a kind of double-faceted, has a kind of double-faceted meaning. And it's often defined or translated as energy in pursuit of the good. Okay, so it's not just really energy on its own, it's energy in pursuit of the good, or skillful effort. And what does Shantideva say about it? Well, the first thing that he says is that virya is not just another perfection. It's not just another word on a list. In fact, it's absolutely crucial. In the very first verse of the chapter, he says, awakening depends upon virya. Okay, so that's pretty crucial, isn't it? If awakening depends upon virya, you're not going to get enlightened unless you've got it. Awakening depends upon virya. Without virya, there is no merit. Just as without wind, there is no movement. He says that virya allows the acting out of all the other perfections. He says the bodhisattva ideal is great, but actually an ideal is not enough. It needs to be put into action. Without virya, there's going to be no patience, no shanti, no ethics, no generosity, no meditation, no wisdom. And it's easy enough to say that. And in a sense, it's easy enough to take it on board. But really seeing that, is actually incredibly important. And Shantideva says not just that it's important, but that it's a matter of life and death that we do understand it. Interestingly, Sangharacharya somewhere else said the real problem, the central problem even of the spiritual life, is how to conserve and unify our energies. He says it's not so much that we lack energy as that we just kind of fritter it away. We do put a bit into the spiritual life, but we spend the rest of it on just all sorts of things, all sorts of trivial activities, all sorts of things that actually are counterproductive to the spiritual life. And Sangharacharya says, if we just gather all our energy together and point it in the right direction, we've got far more than enough energy. We've got enough energy to take us all the way to enlightenment. We just need to marshal it. So that's interesting, because Sangharacharya says, well, you know, we can sign up for the Bodhisattva ideal, but actually, signing up for it doesn't take us very far. We can have a very clear intellectual understanding of the Bodhisattva ideal. We know it's in line with our values. And yes, we know what we've got to do. You know, we've got to come to Sanghanite and learn the Dharma. We've got to meditate. So maybe we have a meditation practice. Maybe we meditate two or three times a week. We go to discussion groups. We do the thing. We go on retreat occasionally. We do the things that are sort of the right sort of things to take us in the right direction. But actually, that only gets us so far. And for many of us, it gets us as far as out of the unhappiness that we're trying to get away from in the first place. And quite often, we plateau there. We sit comfortably there because, well, we're out of the distress, you know, we're out of the uncomfortable place. But, we haven't got that extra push to get us towards enlightenment. I was thinking, it's a bit like standing and looking at a snow-capped mountain and thinking, yeah, I really want to get to the top of that mountain. That's such a beautiful mountain. And we love the idea of getting to the top. And we read books about people who've done it. We buy the gear. We learn the techniques. We do a little bit of fitness training. But, hey, let's not overdo it, you know. We do a bit of fitness training. And then 10 years later, 20 years later, we're part of a comfortable group of people who talk about what it's like at the top of that mountain and exchange news about the people who've done it, and maybe we argue about the best route to the top, but we never actually set off to climb the mountain. And in a way, that's what a lot of us do with a spiritual life. We kind of set off and we do a bit, we do enough to keep us comfortable, but we don't really push to really get us there. And to get up that mountain, we need virya. We need energy. We need a bit of vajra quality. I think probably most of you have come across a vajra. Anyone not come across a vajra? The vajra is the symbolic diamond thunderbolt, which is the symbol of transformative energy. It's got the energy, it symbolizes the energy to break through to enlightenment. So really it's symbolizing the energy which is unconditional love. The energy that is reality, things as they really are. And I also think that it's not surprising that in the mandala of the Buddhas of the Four Directions, two of those Buddhas are holding vajras, because energy is key. Energy is really, really important in the spiritual life. And it's what humans need. Our inclination is to plateau, our inclination is to get comfortable, to get distracted, and to put off making the effort. And we need vajra, we need virya. So, what does Shantideva say about energy? Well, he's quite practical in his chapter on virya. And he talks about two lots of things, really, and those two lots of things are still very relevant to us. The first set of things that he talks about are the things that stop us from being energetic. He talks about the things that block energy. And there's a list of three, and I'll show you them in a moment. And the second set of things he talks about are the things that will help us to generate energy or to release energy. And that's a list of four things. And so I'm going to talk about those two lists, what blocks our energy and what releases energy for us. and give you some of Shantideva's wisdom on the two lists. So, the first list, Shantideva on Virya. What blocks energy? Shantideva says three things block energy. The first is apathy. The second is unwholesome attachments, just being... I did wonder about calling that addictions, but maybe that's too strong, but we'll explain that one in a minute. And the third one is discouragement. These are the three things that just put a damper on our energy, that just stop us from using our energy. And actually, he takes the first two together in a lovely verse, which I'll read to you. He says, "Laziness arises from idleness, indulgence in sensual pleasures, sleeping too much, lounging around, wanting to lean on others, and from apathy about the sufferings of samsara." And I just thought that was fantastic, because it sounds like a list of some people's idea of the proper use of their leisure time. Indulgence in sensual pleasure, sleeping too much, lounging around, wanting to lean on others. I mean, you know, it's what some people do all the time. And actually, I think it's interesting that he lumps together the apathy and indulging in sensual pleasures, because I think he's saying that our addictions to food and drink and sex or comfort, what, you know, whatever it is that we're addicted to, arise from delusion. He says, you know, in answer to the question, why do we lounge around, why do we indulge our addictions, sleep too much and so on, he says, Shantideva says, it's because we're kidding ourselves about reality. About the facts of life and death. He says, when Yama is the mythical lord of death, who would have been well known to the people who Shantideva was talking to, when Yama is sizing you up at every turn, and at every turn the way is blocked, how can it please you to eat? How can you sleep? How make love? So he's saying, apathy equals having your head in the sand, having a head-in-the-sand attitude to existence, pretending that our pleasant distractions, the things that we're kind of occupying our time with at the moment, are going to give us everlasting satisfaction, that we won't die, and that we won't suffer the karmic effects of our self-indulgence. He goes on to say, "Hey you, expecting results without effort, so delicate, so sensitive, caught in the clutches of death and acting as if you were going to live forever. Why are you creating so much future suffering for yourselves? Why are you destroying yourselves? Now that you've managed to get onto the ferry of a human life, cross over the mighty river of suffering. You idiot, don't go to sleep. You'll have to wait a long time to catch this ferry again." And this is a wake-up call at Shantideva gives again and again and again right throughout the Bodhicaryavatara. He's saying one of the basic problems with human existence is delusion. We just don't really see the urgency of our situation. We just want to get comfortable and then forget about the facts of life and death. So, which of us is expecting results without effort? I am. I'd like to think I get them. Who pleases themselves with distractions and sensual pleasures? Who remembers constantly that they must make the best use of this human life? Afraid not. Not me. And actually, I don't think that Shantideva is saying that we shouldn't enjoy ourselves. This is just about fooling ourselves. It's about fooling ourselves that a life spent primarily distracting ourselves, putting most of our energy into pursuing all sorts of pleasures, will still get us to our goal of enlightenment, because it won't. We've got to put our energy behind where we're going, otherwise we won't get there. And he's saying, well, the way to address this kind of laziness is to get real, to remind ourselves what life is really about, and to build our lives around our practice, not about getting as much pleasure as we can out of life. And I suppose that actually in the terminology that we use around here, it's about going for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, rather than going for refuge to External pleasures to comfort and sex and food and all the other things that people go for refuge to. Okay, so that's a bit about the apathy and the unwholesome attachments that block our energy. Interestingly, he has quite a lot to say about discouragement. He says we should be freeing ourselves from despair by practicing the Dharma, not being defeatist, thinking, how could I possibly become awakened? And I'm not sure if this next bit of encouragement works for us, but just try it out for size. He says, even those who in past lives were gnats, mosquitoes, wasps and worms have reached awakening by making the effort. So why shouldn't I, being a human being who can tell the difference between good and bad, attain awakening? Okay, so I'm not sure if the logic does work for us. But actually, I think what he's saying is, if you look at it metaphorically, he's saying, you know, whatever your starting point, you know, from however far back you're starting, even if you're a milarepa and you're starting with a whole lot of negative karma, you can still attain enlightenment as long as you put the energy into it. So he's saying, well, it really is possible. And he's looking at why do we get discouraged? And one of the reasons he says is that because, well, we don't really believe we can make progress. And enlightenment can just seem too far away to be really attainable for us here and now. And actually, I think perhaps another reason is that some of us aren't particularly in the habit of succeeding in anything very much. So we haven't really got successes in our past to kind of power us forward towards success on the spiritual path. In either case, I think perhaps the solution is just to set ourselves some attainable goals. And attainable goals can be very simple. They can be just setting up a regular meditation practice, doing a bit more meditation than we do now. They can be leaving behind a particular piece of unskillful behaviour that we indulge in now. They can be establishing a good habit. Might be, eating less meat, becoming a vegetarian. Might be about improving a particular relationship that we have difficulty with. So, you know, if we work at a small goal, if we set ourselves something that's achievable, and then we see that we've made some progress towards that goal, well, we can take encouragement from that. If we can set ourselves a goal and then achieve it, then, well, we can set ourselves a bigger goal. Another thing that we can do is to set ourselves, you know, sort of progressively bigger goals. So, you know, if we've got a regular meditation practice, if we've become a mitra, if we're doing a bit of mitra study, well, maybe a good hurdle to set ourselves is ordination. Ordination's quite a motivating goal for a lot of people because it's something that's attainable. You know, people from this centre go off and get ordained every year. Nikki at the moment is on her ordination retreat in Spain. But it's something that is difficult, but it's something that we can see that we can achieve. We can see that other people are doing it. We can see ourselves progressing towards it because other people will give us feedback as we go. So one of the things that Shanti Deva says about this, being a practical sort of chap, is that he says, so if you set yourself a goal, make sure it's an achievable goal. And then, for goodness sake, don't abandon it. Because if you abandon it, he said, you'll make it worse. You'll reinforce your tendency to not achieve things. So he's being very practical about it. He says, set yourself a goal and then work towards it. Okay, so those are the things that block our energy. And he's giving us some advice about how to overcome apathy and unwholesome attachments and how to overcome discouragement. And then he gives us some very practical advice about releasing energy. And given what Sangharacharya said about energy being the crucial thing in the spiritual life, this is pretty important advice, really. So the first thing he talks about is something called skillful desire, or Dharma Chanda. Chanda is desire, and so that's desire for the Dharma, desire for the truth. And what Shanti Deva says about this, I'll read first of all. In fact, he has several things to say about it, but I'll read the first verse now. Because in the past I lacked dharmachanda, enthusiastic desire for the good, I find myself in samsara now. Shakyamuni has sung that dharmachanda is the root of all virtue, and the root of dharmachanda is reflecting on the results of karma. Okay, so I'll take the two bits of that separately. So the first thing is that he's saying, well, desire is a great motivator. Human beings generally have plenty of energy for things that they really, really want. And actually, this I'm smiling about this, because this was a lesson that I learned from, actually before I ever came across the Dharma, from an ex-boyfriend of mine. This is my previous incarnation in Norwich. This boyfriend came one night to suggesting that we went for a swim, and then went out for a meal afterwards. And I was very unenthusiastic, both about the swim and about his company. And I said, oh, I'm really tired, you know, I've had a hard day at work. But in the end, I was very ungracious about it, actually. But in the end, I agreed to go just because I thought a swim might wake me up. Anyway, en route to the swimming pool, I needed to call on my sister for a reason that I can't now remember, give her a message about something. And he stayed in the car, my boyfriend stayed in the car, and I nipped into my sister's house just to give her this message. And when I got in, I realised that my brother, who was last heard of in India, had just arrived back from his travels. He'd been away for months and months. And so there were, you know, there was greetings and, you know, great to see him and let's have a meal together and, you know, and suddenly a prospect opened up of having a nice evening with my brother and my sister and some nice food, and we'd be hearing about travels and exchanging news and we'd be laughing, and, you know, suddenly I felt great and I went back out to the car to invite my boyfriend in to join us. And he made a terse but not unkind comment about the difference in my state of mind before and after I went into the house. And that's what happens to us, isn't it? You know, we're really low energy, we really can't be bothered with anything, and something happens that can just kind of completely flip it, completely transform it, and then suddenly we've got energy for something that we really want to do, that we're really going to enjoy. So what Shantideva is saying is that dharmachanda, skillful desire, is about finding a way of channeling that same kind of really enthusiastic energy into the spiritual life. And then the second bit of that verse that I read out earlier is saying, well, Shantideva says the way to do that is to reflect on the results of karma. So most of us will have come across karma. I think probably even the people who've just joined us from the follow-on course. What Shantideva is telling us is that we need to reflect very, very deeply on the benefits of leading a skillful life and the disadvantages of not doing it, until we want to be as skillful as much as we might want a great job or the ideal partner or exam success or whatever else it is, you know, that we're currently really, really wanting. And actually he uses some quite strong comparisons. He uses some very, very strong comparisons, which may sound a bit alien to us, but just bear with it, and I'll talk about it at the end. I'm going to read four verses. Suffering, depression, fear, and obstacles beset those who act unskillfully. But the heart of man who does good brims over with joy, and he's welcomed wherever he goes. The man who does evil also craves appreciation, but wherever he goes, his vices destroy his happiness. The skillful man will dwell in the heart of an expansive, fragrant, cool lotus, his vitality and splendor nourished by the sweet voice of the Buddha, his beautiful body born with the other bodhisattvas in the presence of the Sugata will unfold amidst the light of the sage. And the next bit's really strong. The unskillful man will scream in agony as his skin is torn by the Lord of Death. His body is immersed in molten copper. Chunks of his flesh are hacked away by blazing swords, and again he falls into the red-hot pavement of iron. So meditate on this carefully, he says. Nurturing Dharma Chanda and cultivating it with reverence, then one should develop skillful pride and self-confidence. And actually, I thought about leaving out that verse about the hell. But I visited Vidanya in hospital today. And he was telling me why he wasn't getting much sleep last night, or, well, hasn't had much sleep for several nights. And there's a real problem on the ward he's on with one of the other patients. And this other patient, throughout the night, well, and actually during the day, but it's not such a bother during the day, is calling out. His nights are obviously tormented. He calls out that he's on fire, and he pleads for help to stop the burning needles. And he's obviously in a hell realm. He's occupying a hell realm for most of the night and very much of the day. He's a problem to the staff on the ward. He's a problem to most of the other patients on the ward, most of whom are very impatient with him and yell at him to shut up. And I thought, well, actually, maybe what Shantideva says about the hell realm isn't so far from reality. If we really indulge negative mental states, we can end up being tormented in the way that that chap on Vidanya's ward is tormented. And if you contrast that with the states of mind that are occupied by some of the more skillful and spiritually developed people we know, if you imagine the states of mind occupied by the Dalai Lama or Sangrachita, or even you on a good day, you know, even we can see in our own lives that there are times when we occupy a hell realm and times when we occupy, well, something that's much more like heaven, much more like a pure land. Much more like the description of the pure land, you know, the skillful man who dwells in the heart of an expansive, fragrant, cool lotus. It's meant to be a description of heaven, really, of the pure land of the Buddha. So, if we believe in karma, and we completely take on board that everything we do, everything we say, everything we think, is going to have consequences, and will determine our future lives, then we've got to accept that there's no getting away with it. If we indulge harmful action again and again and again, then we will create a hellish future for ourselves. And the same is true as if we cultivate skillful action. So, just getting back to Shantideva, the key to what he's saying is, the key to releasing energy is to really want to develop, to really want to go in the direction of the good, to really want to develop skillful action and positive states of mind. And just keep remembering that. Okay. Second thing that releases energy, Shantideva says, is self-confidence, tama. And what he says is this: if our mind is weak, even small difficulties bring it down. Defeatism makes us passive, and then it's easy for difficulties to overwhelm us. But if we're vigorous and energetic, even catastrophes can't bring us down. We should firm up our minds and make it difficult for difficulties to beat us. As long as difficulties do beat us, our wish to beat samsara is a joke. We must be the ones who conquer problems and defilements, not letting anything conquer us. This skillful pride should be embedded in our heart, because we are sons of the Buddha, the lion-like conqueror. So, stama, skillful pride, literally means seat or station. It's got implications of strength and self-respect, and it's sort of got chivalric connotations of nobility. So, maybe it's related to chivalric idea of... Kind of looks all right in paper, sounds odd when I say it. So maybe it's related to the chivalric idea of one's seat or one's throne in the hall amongst the noble knights of the king. So it's a kind of noble, upright quality, which also includes just straightforward self-confidence. And Shantideva is saying that taking pride in our spiritual path will really help our energy levels and will help us to overcome obstacles. And we have got quite a lot to be proud of, really. Compared with the majority of beings who are immersed in samsara, we're on a pretty extraordinary path. We've got something precious, something priceless, in which we can in which we can really take pride. The three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, are something that we can really stand on, something that can kind of give us self-respect and give us self-confidence. And yeah, Bodhi, and Shantideva is also at pains to say, and don't mix this up with ordinary pride. Because that comes from seeing ourselves as better than others, and that's not what this is about. And Shantideva shows, he talks about the difference between stama, which is, you know, self-confidence or skillful pride. He shows the difference between that and ordinary pride in a couple of verses which I think are quite poignant because, just remember Shantideva's reputation at the University of Nalanda and then listen to these verses. Those who are conquered by unskillful pride have no real pride at all. A person who has skillful pride is never enslaved, but arrogant folk are enslaved by their enemy, unskillful pride. Those who, though mocked and tortured by the unskillfully proud, remain upright, sustained by skillful pride, they are the heroes. They win a victory over unskillful pride and give away the fruits of victory to all beings. Surrounded and mocked by the defilements, we should be 1,000 times more hotly proud, like a lion in a herd of deer. So he's saying, you know, don't mistake this for ordinary pride. We're not trying to lord it over other people or feel better than other people. We're just taking pride in being on a spiritual path, in having a bigger view of life than just the ordinary things of material existence. So the second way to release energy is to take pride in our practice and not to let difficulties get the better of us. Third thing that Shantideva says will release energy is joy. They're all really nice things, these, aren't they? Things that release energy. Skillful desire, self-confidence and joy. The fourth one's pretty nice as well, but I'll talk about that later. So on joy first. Shantideva says we should be completely focused on the task in hand, intoxicated by it, thirsting for it, like someone making love or trying to win a game. Ordinary folk can't get enough of sensual pleasures, which are like honey on a razor's edge. How can we get enough of honeyed acts of merit, which brings such a sweet result? So as soon as we finish one task, we should plunge into the next like an elephant scorched by the midday sun, plunging into a pool. So he's saying, well, we've got plenty of energy for the things we enjoy, like sex, or trying to win a game of chess, or trying to win a football match, or, you know, whatever it is that we're engaged in. So a trick of the spiritual life is to try to enjoy our practice as much as we can. To find links between the worldly things that we enjoy and our practice of the Dharma. So this is not about advocating tantric sex. Mm-hmm. It's really about, if sense pleasures like eating and sex motivate us, then maybe we should be looking to develop our meditation to the level where we can experience blissful states, we can experience the dhyanas. And if we already do, well, that's great. Use it as an enticement to meditate. When I first got interested in the Dharma, one of the things I was very interested in, well, for many years before that, actually, is art and art history. I used to love going to art galleries. And one of the things that I did when I got really interested in the Dharma was to start looking at books about Buddhist art. And actually, by doing that, I learnt loads about the archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and about the history of Buddhism that I wouldn't otherwise have learned, just by kind of, you know, something that I'd really enjoyed anyway. So Shantideva is giving us good advice. We should be looking to find joy in our practice. And if we haven't got joy in our practice already, thinking, well, how can I put something that I really enjoy in the world? How can I channel that towards practicing the spiritual life? And then finally, Shantideva says, we need to rest occasionally. He says, when our energy begins to flag, we should put our task aside in order to re-engage with it later. When the job is completely finished, We should leave it and look eagerly for the next, and then the next. And I think this Shantideva is just giving some realistic advice here. Part of the secret of having energy is knowing when to rest. But I don't think that it's just about rest and recuperation, actually. I think that rest is important for a different reason as well. Speaking as someone who puts a lot of energy, not all of it, into things that are completely skillful, I know that it's really, really important for me to stop from time to time, because if I don't stop, what I'm likely to do is to just keep on doing things and keep on doing things. And eventually, I begin to lose sight of the bigger picture. I begin to get buried in the things that I'm doing and the sort of the stuff that I'm on with at the moment, and just, you know, I only see what I'm doing now and what the next thing is. I don't kind of rise up and think, well, A, how am I doing on the spiritual path? I don't take the time to think, oh, well, you know, I'm not doing too badly. I can draw some encouragement from that to sort of encourage myself. And I don't think about, well, where am I going next? What should I be working on now? So I think that rest is also important for just getting the bigger picture, for keeping the goal in view, for just reviewing how we're doing and try to encourage ourselves a bit. So the fourth thing that Shantideva thinks that we need to release energy is rest. So, well, I'm almost finished, and all I'm going to do now is to read out some final verses of exhortation from Shantideva about practicing energy. He says, we should always be on the lookout for attacks from the kleshas. The kleshas are the poisons, the three poisons of greed, hate, and delusion. So we should be always on the lookout for attacks from the kleshas and attack them back fiercely, as if we were in a duel with a well-trained enemy. If we ever drop our sword, we must pick it up again quickly. Someone who's undertaken the bodhisattva path should be like someone carrying a jar of oil, watched by a swordsman who will kill him if he spills a drop. If we feel ourselves getting drowsy or lethargic, we should react at once, just as we would jump up if a snake slid into our lap. Okay. So those are pretty strong images, actually. And they give a sense of the way that we should be engaging in our practice, not in a half-hearted, when I feel like it, or, you know, when times are better, when it's a bit easier sort of way, but urgently and with all our attention. If we can develop enough enjoyment, enough dharma chanda, enough pride and joy in our practice, and rest occasionally to take stock, then we might be surprised by just how much energy we seem to have. And for some of us, it will probably seem as if we're literally making progress without making any effort at all, because that's what virya does for us. Just as though we were being blown along by an external force, because what we most want to do is to make spiritual progress.